questions that have a financial price tag at the end have a habit of sharpening the mind. So the theory of change is it will cause these companies to look at their long-term strategy and weigh the pros and cons of increasing, either starting new projects or expanding existing projects that are not in line with containing global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels.
Hi there, I'm Jamie Williamson, Managing Editor of Financial Standard, and welcome to today's episode of The Greener Way, where we're taking a bit of a deep dive into effective engagement with Australia's big banks. U Ethical Investors recently released its latest climate risk report, which highlights its efforts in collaborating with our five major banks and increasing pressure on them to align their financing with the Paris Agreement. We have a very familiar voice to talk us through this today, U Ethical's stewardship manager and a very dear friend of the podcast, Rachel Allen Backus. Rachel, welcome back to The Greener Way.
Well, I thank you very much, Jamie Williamson, and I'm enjoying the novelty of being interviewed by you.
Rachel, as I said, we're going to go through how U Ethical is engaging with banks, but perhaps a good starting point for today's conversation is to tell us briefly about U Ethical's broader climate strategy and how climate-related risks are managed by the team.
Sure. And look, I'll take a really wide view and then I'll go increasingly more and more specific. So yep. To start off at the highest level, U Ethical is an ethical fund manager that's been around for nearly 40 years. We're a not-for-profit and a B Corp. And taking into account the E, the S, and the G, as well as ethical decision-making that's grounded in our roots as being part of the Uniting Church of Victoria and Tasmania, means that we have integrated environmental risks almost since the very start, if not the very start, of what we've done. As part of that, we are long-term investors. And as investors, we view climate change as a systemic risk that poses specific risks to the companies on our portfolios, as well as some opportunities. So as that is sort of the context, climate risk is something that's managed by all parts of the investment team, not just myself as the stewardship manager and my colleague, who's our senior investment analyst for responsible investment. It's part of the decision making and it's built into our investment models. So what does that really mean? We view managing these risks and opportunities as part of our mandate and as part of the process of delivering risk-adjusted return for our clients through an ethical lens. We also believe that aligning investment portfolios with a low-carbon transition and a climate-just transition that has regards for workers' rights and community health will help manage risk and contribute to long-term financial performance in healthy economies. And so it sort of makes a tight, joined-up circle. We do it because it's part of our belief system. We do it because we have an investment thesis for it. And we do it because we think it will create the sort of future that we would like to see.
Now on the banks, U Ethical is coordinating direct engagement with ANZ, Commonwealth Bank, NAB, Westpac, and Macquarie Group in efforts to curb their financing of fossil fuel projects. Can you tell us more about this and what it's actually involved so far?
Sure. So this is a collaborative engagement, Jamie, that was started before I joined U Ethical. And we're working with a number of aligned investor peers who are seeking information and action. We as U Ethical are invested in all of those banks. And the goal of the engagement is to ensure that the bank's high-level commitments to transition to net zero are being implemented in a timely fashion, in line with the work of phasing out financing of new and expanded fossil fuel projects that are not aligned with the Paris Agreement. These banks have made commitments to curtail lending that's not aligned to the Paris Agreement ends. And our job here as investors, because we believe that that is the thing to do, again, from a financial perspective as well as a climate risk perspective, is to work with them, communicate our desires for more information and for more action on their commitments, as well as support them in meeting those goals. So this is something, as I said, that's now a multi-year collaboration. It started in 2024. There have been a couple of rounds of meetings with the banks. We're a lead investor with Macquarie Bank, and we support the engagement with Westpac and CBA. As a result of this collaborative action, we're able to pool insights and to gain clarity on whether the banks will make further commitments and how they'll actually implement the commitments that they've made. We take that information and that informs our views, both as investments in these banks, as well as how we do things like proxy voting at the 2024 AGM season. And this is sort of a critical input for the work that I do as stewardship manager, because I'm responsible for voting on the proxies in the companies that we hold in our portfolios. We at UEthical supported three shareholder resolutions, one at NAB, one at ANZ, one at Westpac, that asked for enhanced disclosure and rigor around the transition plan assessments of banks in the way that they look at their banking clients. And I'll go into that a little bit. So each of these banks has said that they will stop lending to businesses that they feel are not aligned to the transition to net zero. They're going to assess all of their, they've committed to assessing all of their clients and making a decision by 2025 to stop lending to laggards and to work progressively to get their clients in a position where they feel that their transition plans are realistic and the targets are robust. That's a very big endeavor, and it requires a lot of work on behalf of the banks. And we really want to know how they're planning on doing that. And so engaging with this helps us gain greater clarity and to also assist in assessing the risk-adjusted return profile of our portfolios and then advocate for efficient decarbonization of the Australian finance sector and the economy overall.
So part of the motivation for this is also around getting more comprehensive and transparent data from the banks to assist that decision-making. What are the challenges that investors face on this front? Like, what's actually missing from the data currently?
Look, the data is improving and will continue to improve. At the beginning of the year, the Australian Sustainable Standards Accounting Standards came into effect, and the largest companies, which include all of the banks, will have to start disclosing around Scope 1, Scope 2, and Scope 3 emissions more robustly in terms of their financial impacts from July 1 of this year. So to a certain extent, asking for more information or asking banks to commit to disclosing this information, that's a campaign that's already been won because it's now legally obligated on these companies. To that extent, that information will continue to improve. The banks pretty well disclose on their Scope 1 and Scope 2 emissions. So, you know, Scope 1 is within their operations. Scope 2 are things that they purchase in, like electricity, gas, heating. It's really Scope 3, which is the emissions that are generated as a result of their business. And so for banks, that's the financed emissions. So what carbon emissions do their lending clients generate because they've had lending and finance from the banks? And that's a big challenge, right? Ascribing financial value to Scope 3 emissions has sort of perennially been the big ask. The accounting standards go a long way to achieving that because they provide comparability and transparency, which really helps us as investors be able to compare banks on a like-for-like basis. Then when banks have fully been able to surface their Scope 3 financed emissions, the question will then be, how do they manage the trade-offs, right? Because banks are in the business of making money, ultimately for their shareholders, as well as guaranteeing finance through systems, all the things that we know about the functions that a bank performs. And banks are making risk-adjusted decisions in their own right about how they lend, the cost of capital of that lending, and the way that climate risk and financed emissions plays into that decision-making. And so it's a big process. It requires a lot of competency and upskilling by all of these banks as well. And it's something that we're following through as investors in all of these companies.
You mentioned that it requires competency and upskilling. How have the banks actually been responding? Like, what's the response been like? Are they open to doing more and being more transparent and taking on that kind of responsibility to upskill?
The banks have had, there's been a spectrum of responses by the banks and a spectrum of commitments by the banks. CBA has taken, you know, a very big stance on this. Westpac, NAB, ANZ have all also outlined, at least at a high level, the process that they're going to take in terms of how they categorize their clients. So there's going to be, I think they've all taken a quartile approach to it. So it's, you know, those that they feel are sufficiently aligned to net zero aims, then three categories underneath leading, and then the fourth category being the laggards, where they feel that the transition plans are insufficient or unrealistic. And then they say that they will make lending decisions. So most of the banks are going to stop lending to that lowest category, the ones with insufficient transition plans or transition plans that don't really meet the mark. They're going to stop lending to those clients by the end of 2025. But then there's all sorts of questions like, who's making the assessments on those transition plans? Is it internal staff that have become skilled to sort of weigh science-based targets and things like that? Is it a third-party provider that's going to make that assessment and provide a report to the bank to make that call? Questions like, then what happens if the client says, actually, no, we don't think your judgment's correct. We do think our transition plan is robust. You know, what does that process look like? And in those categories, sort of in that second and third quartile, where there's work that needs to be done on uplift, how do the banks respond there? Do they increase lending covenants? Is there an increased cost of capital and through a higher interest rate? And how do they manage those trade-offs themselves? It's been, all of the banks have met with us in the groups, and then all investors as well. We also have direct engagement. So, you know, again, as we own all of these banks in our portfolio, I and my colleagues on the investment team have had meetings with these banks to sort of raise individual points. So they do come to the table. They do have specialists that, in not just in investment relations, but also ESG reporting specialists that will answer our questions. So from that perspective, there's enhanced transparency and progress on that. It's just coming down to the actual how. And you know this as a journalist, Jamie. You know, we're never satisfied, are we? We really want to know, you know, as clearly as possible with as much evidence as possible that what they claim they're doing is what they're doing. So it's a lot of focusing on the whys and the hows at this point.
Yeah. Well, the journalist in me is going to go off script for a second because I have a follow-up question to that, which is to what extent then, so if they're going to stop the financing by the end of 2025, that's obviously good news in terms of like it's a good outcome for your engagement. But to what extent do you then kind of consider like, well, where are these projects going to get the financing from then? Like, are we really having a success moment here, or are we kind of passing the problem down the line a little bit?
It's such a good question, JB. Look, the reality is that, you know, if the Australian banks aren't providing financing on some of these fossil fuel projects, it is entirely likely that other sources of capital will come to the fore, whether it's non-Australian banks, whether it's private lenders, whether some of these companies are in a position to finance this off their balance sheets directly. What it indicates, though, is that it increases the cost of acquiring that money, either that you have to arrange for new relationships with banks that you may not previously worked with, you have to seek other means of financing, and you're going through this process of, you know, where your stakeholder, if you are the company, you've got stakeholders that are asking you these questions, whether it's your investors, whether it's regulators, whether it's your financing partners and the banks. And questions that have a financial price tag at the end have a habit of sharpening the mind. So the theory of change is it will cause these companies to look at their long-term strategy and weigh the pros and cons of increasing, either starting new projects or expanding existing projects that are not in line with containing global warming to 1.5 degrees centigrade above pre-industrial levels.
Yeah. Does it have an impact for you, though, as like the investor who's done all this engagement? Like, is it better for you to, you know, maintain the investment in the banks than rather than not knowing where the financing for other projects is coming from, if that makes sense?
Sure. I guess this is the divestment question, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so, yeah.
And like, yeah, look, I mean, you know, as an ethical investor, we do hold divestment as a tool where we feel that there is no progress across a number of things, financial as well as ethical or sustainable. You know, we are investors, we buy and we sell. We do hold the banks as a long-term investor because we feel that they offer a good opportunity for our clients in terms of risk-adjusted return and are well-positioned for where we are in the economy right now or the economic cycle right now. And, you know, the flip side to the divestment question is, well, if you don't have a seat at the table as an investor, you don't really get a say. U Ethical does not invest in fossil fuel producers beyond a really tight materiality threshold. You know, none of the fossil fuel companies are going to talk to us when we go to them and ask them to stop, you know, adjust their plans, you know. But we do have a seat at the table with the banks. We use it judiciously. We give them positive feedback where they feel they're making progress. We ask sharp questions where we feel that, you know, they're exposed to risk or are missing out on opportunities. And as a long-term investor and holder in capital, we feel that that's a part of our responsibility, particularly to our clients.
Okay, so going beyond the banks for a minute, what were some of the other major findings of U Ethical's climate risk report?
Sure. Well, so the role of the Climate Risk Report, Jamie, is to report on our progress. We use the Task Force for Climate-Related Financial Disclosures as our base framework. We're not in a position to start using the Australian Sustainable Accounting Standards at this time, but we feel that the TCFD framework does allow for sort of a quantitative and a qualitative way to express what we're working on. Our portfolio continues to remain below the ASX 300 when it comes to carbon intensity, because, as I said, we don't invest in fossil fuel companies. We also tend to look for opportunities in companies that are aligned to that long-term goal of net zero by 2050. There's some surprising pockets. We are invested in data centers and in companies that operate and own and operate data centers. And, you know, you look at the scope three in data centers is a real issue for the industry. And so the exercise of the Climate Risk Report allows us to run a really judicial eye on our portfolio for its, you know, the risks and opportunities that allows me to prioritize the resource of stewardship that I represent so that I'm actually engaging with companies in ways that are effective for us.
So with all that in mind, my final question for you, it obviously wouldn't be a conversation about sustainability in 2025 without some mention of Trump. Mm-hmm. How has the quite drastic change in sentiment that's kind of followed his election, you know, over the last 6 or so months, how has that changed or impacted Youethical's efforts?
To a large extent, not at all, Jamie. And again, this has to do with the fact that, you know, who we are as Youethical, our foundation as being a fund manager for major clients of the Uniting Church for Victoria and Tasmania. Our ethical charter hasn't changed because we come out of this foundation and our clients are strongly aligned to achieving ESG goals because it's not only does it make good investment sense, it also acts in accordance with the ethics that they want to see. So to a certain extent, and this is the benefit of working for an organization that's been around for 40 years, this, you know, Youethical has seen the ebbs and flows around everything to do with sustainability through that 40 years. And having that long-term view and understanding that the science shows us and that analysis shows us that well-governed quality companies have a regard for material, environmental, social, and corporate governance issues. And well-governed quality companies are more likely to have risk-adjusted return over time. It's a very simple thesis that's actually it's grounded in, you know, the numbers of making financial return for our clients. So to a large extent, my work continues, you know, mostly unaffected. But yeah, the political context, you know, stewardship and engagement is about negotiating with companies. It's about negotiating with systemic risks through things like policy submissions and advocacy for policies. And yeah, so the operating context, you have to have a regard for the way that sentiment is ebbing and flowing. I ground myself really strongly, again, in our foundations and in the fact that having a regard for material ESG issues actually makes investment sense. And we are here as a fiduciary to make strong investment returns. And so if you plant yourself in those two, you know, on those two foundations, it really works quite well.
Well, that is a very positive note to end on, I think. Rachel, thank you so much again for coming on The Green Away today.
Oh, you're a great interviewer, Jamie, and I'm glad to be back with you.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind. And thank you so much for joining us on The Green Away today as well. We look forward to seeing you next time.
The Green Away podcast is a product of FS Sustainability. All information in this podcast is for education and entertainment purposes only. It is not intended as a substitute for professional, legal, or tax advice. Before making any financial decisions, you should read the product disclosure statement, and if necessary, consult a licensed financial professional. For more information, head to the disclaimer page on the FS Sustainability website, fssustainability.com.au.